580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Joel Shoemaker from Iowa City, Iowa. We're talking with him by phone, and our subject is finding yourself in young adult literature. Joel is just recently retired, a school librarian and a former president of the board of the Young Adult Library Services Association, and we're happy to have him on the air. Can you hear me okay, Joel?
I do, Brother Steve. Hello.
Very good. And I should explain quickly that Joel, although he is one of my brothers, nevertheless, believe it or not, is an expert in his field. And I'd hope to have him on this show for some time, but recently I had a cancellation and he was kind enough to slip in on short notice. And so I'm delighted that he's able to be with us today.
You probably should just warn people now, Steve, how many brothers you've got left.
Yeah. We do come from a family of four boys. And our mother, believe it or not, is listening today, probably most likely. So at any rate, Joel and I are going to talk about young adult literature, and particularly religious themes, spiritual themes, values, ethics found in such books, since that's a concentration of this show. Joel, first of all, what is young adult literature?
Well, that's an excellent question to start with, and it's a difficult one to answer. One very broad answer is that it's books that teenagers read. But that's an inadequate answer in some ways. Most people start by talking about the age of the readers and what is a young adult. Why do we call them young adults instead of teenagers or children or kids or something else? So I'd like to talk about that for just a minute, if
sure.
I may. The group that you mentioned that I was president of is a division of the American Library Association. I was president of a division called the Young Adult Library Services Association. And as you know, our language changes over time, and that organization changed its name back in the 80s to include the terms young adult as a sign of respect, really, because teenagers is one group of people in our society that tend not to get any respect. They're sort of the Rodney Dangerfield of life's ages, I think. For example, in the newspaper, when do we read about teenagers except on the sports page or when they've gotten caught doing something wrong and committed a criminal act? We don't often get good news about teenagers in other ways. In the library world, we wanted to make sure that teenagers have a place. In other words, everybody likes children. Every public library has a children's collection. But there was a time when there really wasn't a teen collection. It wasn't until the 1960s that there started to be books specifically purchased, marketed, offered to teenagers as a separate group of people from children. And the reason for this was several different things that came together, really, but mostly had to do with the move toward realism. There had always been books in libraries for teenagers to read, but they tended to be about the majority class, middle class, majority values, tended not to be very realistic, at least by today's standards. And all that started to change in the 60s.
How broad, I guess, what's the range for these books that are considered young adult?
Is it
literally from 13 to 19, or what does it really mean?
Yeah, thanks for bringing me back to that. I remember that YALSA defines their client group, the people we serve, as ages 12 to 18.
12 to 18.
But there's another subdivision of the American Library Association called the American Library Services to Children, the ALSC group, that works with children, and they define children as being up to the age of 14.
Okay.
So there's an overlap between 12 and 14 where we think the services and the literature can serve both older, mature children up to age of 14 and younger teenagers, 12 to 14.
I'm mentoring a young man, a young boy, a young adult who is 13, and we're reading a book together, Bud Not Buddy, that was set back in the Depression, and it's kind of a way to learn a little bit of American history, and it's written by an African-American author, and the young man I'm mentoring is African-American, and he's learned some fascinating things from that book we're reading together.
Absolutely. Christopher Paul Curtis is an excellent author, has won some major awards for his books. He's a fascinating individual. He used to be on the auto assembly plants in Flint, Michigan, and thought about books he wanted to write, worked at night to write his first books out, if I recall correctly, in longhand and at the kitchen table, and finally broke through and got published, and has just done a marvelous job producing some very interesting books for our younger teen readers.
So one thing listeners will get today are some suggestions of some really good books for young people of this age. So you might want to have your pencil and paper together, or your notes thing on your iPhone or whatever, to take some notes from what Joel Shoemaker will be sharing with us today. And let me repeat that author. That was Christopher Paul Curtis, and Bud Not Buddy is the particular book I was mentioning. Do you recall other titles of his that you particularly would recommend, Joel? I know that's a cold question.
Yeah, Bud Not Buddy. No, right off the top of my head.
Okay,
that's
fine.
I'm drawing a blank. I'd have to find it for you.
Well, or people could consult with your local librarian, yes.
Absolutely. Here.
Always a good idea. Well, since I've started this off by asking you a question that was not fair.
I'm going to back up and tell you. Bucking the Sarge was one.
Okay.
He wrote another historical fiction book called Elijah of Buxton about an African-American community in Canada that was just fascinating back And I believe it was just pre-Civil War days, about a community that it was formed by slaves who had escaped from the United States, primarily. But his first big book was The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963.
Oh, okay.
A really warm-hearted family story that ends with a very surprising, almost surreal tie-in to what we know of actual history from 1963 and the bombing of the church where the three girls, I believe, were killed. Yeah,
let me give phone numbers for listeners who will ask, who can also challenge you with cold questions right off the cuff. The number in Champaign-Urbana where this program originates is 217-333-9455. So just punch in 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code. If it's a long-distance call for our listeners, including people who are on the Internet, do punch in 1-800-222-9455. That's a toll-free call. Again, anywhere the program can be heard, you can use a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And of course, we are being heard online at will.illinois.edu on the AM channel there. Well, Joel, when we're talking about the age span for young adult literature that librarians use, what do people look for in books for that age? What causes a librarian to order a book that's written for people of that age?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what I hope as a librarian who has served on some selection committees that try to make lists of the best books is that we're going to find the best possible books for our kids to read. We want the best books for teenagers to have the same qualities as any other best book. I think, in fact, teen books right now are at a point where some of the best writing being done anywhere is being done for teenagers. Very experimental, very interesting, creative kinds of things being brought to the teen environment.
Give us some examples.
That means we want books that will grab a kid and keep his attention and hopefully transform them, get them someplace where they haven't been before. Like any work of art, like any art. We expect that to mirror our times, our culture, or the time at least that the book is representing, because we do have a lot of historical fiction that's out there. And, of course, science fiction and fantasy come into play a lot. All the traditional genres that are popular with teenagers and other readers, can explore these religious, moral, and other kind of spiritual issues.
So when you picked as a topic for this show, finding yourself in young adult literature, you feel that this is not only literature that teenagers can appreciate and enjoy and learn something from and be, as you say, transported by, but also older readers.
Absolutely. You know, there's a new category of books that people are writing about for the last 5 or 10 years that we call crossovers. You know, books that start out as children's books but cross over to the adult world. So, the two most recent examples that everybody's familiar with, the J.K. Rowling Harry Potter books, the first book came out, published, of course, first in Britain and then a year later over here, and became popular. But nobody reading that first book knew that it was going to become a worldwide, international, multi-million-selling phenomenon. And yet, by the time the third book was out, it had caught fire to the point where, that's where it eventually headed and ended up. And then just a few short years later here, was it 95, the Twilight book came out, by Stephanie Meyer, the romance involving a girl and the vampire guy has been made into a movie, and again, Runaway as a media platform, promoted in movies, games, every possible format, the music, everything is tied together now in the marketing effort. And the question there, of course, is, who's going to get the next one? Nobody who was looking at Harry Potter could have anticipated that Stephanie Meyer would be the next one to trip that trigger with Twilight. And nobody knows now what will be the next big thing that will become a phenomenon that might cross over from children's teen books to adult. The other thing used to happen more, I'm looking at a copy here I have of Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger, published in 1951 or two, I think. And, that's a teen that's become a classic with teen readers. Everybody reads it sometime in junior high, high school, college, studies it, literature classes, and so forth. And yet it was published for adults. At the time that it was published in the early 50s, there was no separate part of the publishing house for teens. There was no separate teen collection. And, of course, with the language and the themes, the content of that book, few libraries, public or school or any other kind, would have put it in a children's collection. But now it's a staple in at least school young adult collections, because the literary quality is recognized and, it's a popular title that students often request and want to read. So we used to talk about crossovers from adult to teen. Now we're talking more about going the other direction.
Now, the two you mentioned that would have just been multi-million dollar sellers, the Harry Potter series and the Twilight series, how are they viewed in terms of their literary value by professionals?
Well, you'll sure get mixed opinions about that, as you would about anything else. Try to come up with a definition of what you mean by literary quality. Uh-huh. All of our selection committees that I've been part of have to answer that question one way or another for themselves. For example, I was on a committee called the Best Books for Young Adults. Well, best implies that some books are not best, right? It's at least the top 50% of books would be the best one. And maybe you want to be a little, more critical in your evaluation and say, well, the best is only the top 10% of all the books that are published. But wherever you draw that line, you have to come up with a personal and, when you're working on a committee, a group idea about what you mean by best. The two big parts of that for us are usually what we summarize as quality and popularity. So quality issues have to do with the language that's used, the sustaining of a mood throughout the book, the beauty inherent in the language, the structure, perhaps the production of the book itself, how it's laid out on the page. Is it done in a creative way? Like I say, books that are being written now in free verse poetry. I know you had an earlier program where you interviewed Helen Frost that does some remarkable poetry that are written as novels for teenagers, Keisha's House and another one that I think I'm forgetting the name of. And so you look at the over, you arrive at, you look at all the different characteristics that a book has and try to come up with your feeling about whether or not this meets your standards for quality. But the other thing is popularity. And some people, you know, how easy is it going to be for a student, a teenager, a young adult to read and enjoy this book? The two can be divorced, and there's one of our selection committees in YALSA called the Michael L. Prince Award where those two are divorced from each other. It is only judged on the basis of literary quality. Each committee each year is 10, I think 9 new librarians and an advisor from the Booklist magazine, 10 people who sit around a table and come up with their own selections of the best books for teenagers of the year based solely on literary quality. Most of the other committees strike some kind of a balance between quality and popularity. Will a teenager read this book? Will they like it? Is it something that would appeal to them? Is it a subject that they want to know about? Those sorts of things enter into discussion. So some people say you can't divorce them, that you can't judge a literary quality for a teenage book without looking at popularity. And some of us think you can.
Was
internal debate.
Was Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer written for this age group or adults or both or what? Do we have any idea what was in his mind when he...
Well, exactly. How would you know?
Yeah.
Unless he wrote about it and told somebody, which I'm not familiar enough with his literature to know. I was looking at another antecedent, Treasure Island, I was thinking about.
Sure.
You know, who was Treasure Island written for in 1880, whatever?
Yeah.
As that Scottish author sat down and wrote that book, which is certainly appreciated by children. You know, I remember reading it to my kids and I'm being quite enthralled with it, but I was reading it along with them and being equally enthralled. And so most authors write for themselves, right? Most authors end up saying, I write because I want to learn something. I want to learn from the act of writing what I think about this or how I feel about that. And they write as an act of self-discovery. Those writers who get published simply have often written something that appeals to another reader besides themselves. That editor being the first person that maybe picks it up off the slush pile, or their agent, or, and then whoever it gets marketed to. And that's a real interesting issue. There's a guy named Bruce Brooks, that was here at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop, which this weekend just celebrated their 75th anniversary. We had Jane Smiley and all the famous folks here in town this weekend. And Bruce Brooks graduated from the Writers' Workshop, I think about mid-'80s, late-'80s, wrote his first book, The Moves Make the Man, and had no idea that it was going to be published for adults. You know, he was writing it for his peer group, the people essentially in the Writers' Workshop at the time, and when it was accepted by a publisher, they said, this is a great, great teen book. We're going to market it to teenagers. And that just happens over and over and over in our world, in the world of young adult literature. Authors write books not knowing that they are writing a teen book. And the opposite can happen. Jeremy Jackson, another recent graduate of the Writers' Workshop here, I read his first book called Life at These Speeds. And it's a marvelous book. Great story for teens, but it was marketed on the adult side and basically, sank out of sight. If it had been marketed for teens, I'm confident it would have made a big splash and people would have noticed and his book would have been notable in our world.
Repeat that title again.
Life at These Speeds, about a young man who becomes a top cross-country runner in high school.
And the author again was Bruce Brooks?
That's Jeremy Jackson.
I'm sorry.
J-A-C-K-S-O-N. Bruce Brooks' book I mentioned earlier was called The Moves Make the Man,
about
a basketball player and a best friend back in, I think, North Carolina.
Oh. Let me reintroduce our guest today on Keeping the Faith. This is one of my brothers, Joel Shoemaker from Iowa. He has been the chair of the Best Books for Young Adults Committee in the past. He served on the board of the Young Adult Library Service Association and, in fact, served as president of YALSA, one of the branches of the American Library Association. He has a couple degrees from here at the University of Illinois, his undergraduate degree in English education, and then a master's specializing in reading. And then he also has a second master's in librarianship from the University of Northern Iowa. He is an adjunct professor at the University of Iowa, as well as University of Northern Iowa, and teaches there in those schools of library and information sciences. He has published extensively reviews of best books for young adults, and has served as a school librarian for 25 years in the last 20 or so in Iowa City until he retired just a year ago. Joel Shoemaker from Iowa City is our guest, and again, the phone number is to ask a question or make a comment or perhaps to suggest a book that you think is great for young adults and others. 333-9455 will put you in touch with our engineer here in the studio, Kyle Crowe. She'll take your call and get you in line to speak with our guest. If it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. That's a toll-free call. And, of course, if you've missed part of this program, you can hear it. It'll be archived at the WILL website within a week or two, and you can hear it at your leisure through your computer. And that's at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And you can just leave the G off of keeping. We're very informal, and you'll find all the archives there and can listen. Also, former earlier programs, of course, are there going back a number of years. Well, let's get back to our discussion about some of the what you find, how you can find yourself in young adult literature. Do you think we're all lost, Joel?
Yeah, let me tell you a little more about why I thought of that topic. First, I found myself in young adult literature, right? I've been stuck here for my whole life. It turns out, you know, I never left. I read a lot of these books when I was growing up. I read as a teenager a lot, and as an undergraduate reading for an English education, I had a course in young adult literature. Reflected on what I'd read up to that point and found some new things. For example, at that time, The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton, 1967, was still relatively new. You know, when I was in college in 71 in that course. And it's one of those groundbreaking books that kind of turned the tide toward what was called the New Realism, where language, situations, topics that had never been used in teen books started to enter the genre. And so that the modern age really of young adult literature could be dated from about the time I was in high school and college in the late 60s and early 70s. So finding yourself also refers to the fact that as a librarian, one of my goals was always to make sure that every kid in my school could find himself somewhere in my collection. Now that means, again, if you go back to the Leave It to Beaver days in the early 60s, you know, the books were all about white people, middle-class people, people who were married, and topics like divorce and death and the sad, terrible, tragic topics that are the stuff of what we call the realistic problem novel were not included. And so as the literature entered, went through the 70s and through the 80s to our present decade and century, books have more and more become inclusive. We have books, certainly the 60s were a time when the question was asked, why aren't there books by black authors in these libraries? Why aren't there books with people of color as protagonists that feature settings other than middle-class ones? And, of course, since then, that ball has just kept rolling and accelerating in different directions, including different kinds of people, audiences, groups, that previously have perhaps been excluded.
We have a caller waiting. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with Joel Shoemaker.
Hi, thank you, Joel. I'm wondering, since you've been so immersed in that genre, if you've ever been tempted yourself to write a book.
Well, immersed is the word I reflect on quite often. Sometimes I feel like I'm drowning, right? The new books come in so fast, and I want to read them all, and I can't keep up. So,
sure.
Yeah, I have given thought to that, but I've never been as good at sitting down and writing something as I am at thinking about them. So, no, yeah. I've mostly focused on nonfiction. I have done some things there about librarianship and for teenagers, but fiction has so far eluded me.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. A great show.
Thank you for the question. When you read some of these new books, when one comes, I know you get piles of them as when you serve on these committees that decide which are the best books that you're recommending to librarians all over the country, all over the world, the English-speaking world. How much does it matter that you know the author to start with? Does a beginning author really have a chance?
That's a good question. When I'm working on a committee or if I'm reviewing a book, I try not to even notice who it is. You know, I try to pick up the book cold. If it has a paper slip cover on it, as they sometimes do when they come as galleys or arcs, I just put it away and just go to page one. If there's any introductory material or material that was written by the publisher, I just ignore it. I like to start with page one and just take the book as it comes. Now, that said, there are times when a pile of books comes and the first thing I do is go through it and see who I recognize. And maybe those books go to the top of my pile. I might read them first.
Yeah.
You know, if it's not something I'm reviewing, if it's not something I'm considering for an award, I sometimes tip the scale in favor of somebody who I've liked in the past and want to make sure I don't miss. So that's just two distinct approaches there.
Now, I know from your bio that you were the founding editor of a series of books called Teens at the Library. How did that come about? Did a publisher just decide that they wanted to specialize in teen books?
Let's see. How did that come about? I had finished my term as president of YALSA, and I was approached by a publisher about working on a series of books for teenagers and ended up making a general proposal that was accepted in the late, see, it's about the turn of the century, right? About 2000, the population of teens was forecasted to keep rising for the next decade, and that has indeed happened. The schools up until the last year or two have been growing and growing, and so I just made a proposal that, you know, with the increased number of teens coming into the system and the explosion of books for teens, that there should be a new series of books that would help people meet their needs in both school and public libraries. So what we've done with that series through the years is just try to find writers who have an interesting perspective on librarianship for teens and could write about it. So we started with a book called Hold Them in Your Heart by Joanne Wood Downey from Enoch Pratt Library in Baltimore. The subtitle there was Successful Strategies for Library Services to At-Risk Teens. And then a friend of mine named Patrick Jones and I wrote a book called Do It Right, Best Practices for Serving Young Adults in School and Public Libraries, where we reflect from our different perspectives, mine in the school and his in the public library, about what the important things are in serving teenagers. I won't give you the whole series, but we did books on book talkings, about talking about books with teenagers by Jennifer Broman, a young librarian in the Chicago area. Steve Miller did a book for me called Developing and Promoting Graphic Novel Collections. Graphic novels is what we used to call comic books. Of course, there are many different forms and formats now in book-length books. Teen Readers Advisor by Rosemary Hunold. She's now the editor of VOYA, the Voice of Youth Advocates, another library journal that serves librarians who serve teens. Jennifer Huber did a wonderful book called Reading Rants, A Guide to Books That Rock. Reading Rants is also one of my favorite websites that she's done now for more than 10 years, I think. Huh. So we got about 20 12 or 13 books in that series before I asked to step aside as series editor and handed it off to another person.
I want to get back to some of these topics like graphic novels and science fiction and so on and get some more suggestions for good books. We have another caller, line one, a call from Urbana. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, Steve and Joel. How are you today?
Hi. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, it was a great lead-in for my question. I'm a former fifth-grade teacher and current elementary principal, and have been using graphic novels myself in the classroom and have been reading quite a bit about it lately, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on them. I found a great resource lately, the Graphic Novel Reporter. It's a website. And they have a column or a part of it every 2 weeks when it comes out on profiling teachers who use graphic novels in classrooms.
Cool.
So I'd like to hear some comments about that. But I also wanted to say I loved what you said about having been a consumer of young adult literature all your life and haven't ever left it. And I consider myself the same. I'm a contemporary age-wise of you, and I alternate between science fiction and young adult literature when I'm reading for fun. So I'm going to hang up and
before you ring off. Let me just ask
sure.
you what were some of the first books you read as when you were at this age?
Some of the first books I read, well, I would only read nonfiction for a long time until I discovered Jules Verne.
Oh, okay.
Probably in fifth grade, and then discovered a whole raft of young adult books, Eleanor Cameron's Mushroom People series, and things like the Mad Scientist Club, which I was excited to find in the basement of my school, because I remember ordering it from Scholastic Book Club. Tom Swift Jr. books, those kinds of things. And then from there, it just, branched out. Sherlock Holmes, things like that. Typical boy stuff.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for sharing. Appreciate the call.
No, don't let it go yet.
Wait, don't hang up. Joel has a question.
Okay.
As an elementary principal, you sound like a remarkable role model. I hope you're carrying some of those graphic novels around with your briefcase as you roam the hall.
I have, my office is quite the place to be, so kids like to come, and it's more from when they get in trouble. So. It's pretty good, but fortunately I have a library media specialist who's also into graphic novels, and we're finding it we're able to reach a lot of kids who have not been able to access literature as a source of pleasure before. So
absolutely, that's what it is. It's another door in, to get kids to read.
Right.
That might not otherwise do so.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
There's a graphic novel that won one of our big awards, the Prince Award, a few years ago by Jean Yang, Yang, called American Born Chinese. And again, this is a book I know I've done some interview with Jean on one occasion. He wrote from his heart. He had been working in graphic novels for years. He's a teacher at a private high school in San Francisco area at the time. Does technology support work and taught mathematics, various math classes. And he cartooned because he'd grown up loving cartoons. And he cartooned it at night, and he learned the processes and so forth and was just committed to it as an act of love, and ended up producing this award-winning book called American Born Chinese, which is one of those books that can be read any place between, the teen years and an adult. And you can get different meanings from it and extract more and more every time you read. It's very richly layered, very beautifully produced, well worth reading about to get further insights from people who know more about it than I do online. And he has some websites you can easily find online as well. But he has, the last time I looked, I think three different websites, one devoted primarily to that book, I think, and a couple others that have other information about his work through the years. And you know, certainly that book sets a standard that others are striving to meet. But there's the whole field of graphic novels has just exploded. It's been increasing in popularity since really Spiegelman's mid-80s book about the Holocaust, Mouse, and then the follow-up to that, My Father Bleeds History, I think was the subtitle, Mouse 2. And, what began as Spiegelman was an underground, what we call now an underground comic artist in the 70s, and burst onto the Pulitzer Prize-winning scene and with Mouse in the 80s, and it helped legitimize what people used to denigrate as comics and now recognize as another legitimate form of literature.
We're a little bit past halfway in our program today, talking about finding yourself in young adult literature with our guest from Iowa City, Joel Shoemaker, who I did acknowledge earlier, is one of my brothers. We'll be getting back to Joel in just a minute. My name is Steve Shoemaker, and I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, although Don Nolan fills in admirably when I do need to be away. Next week on Keeping the Faith, Eric Freifogel will be our guest. He's a professor at the School of Law here at the University of Illinois, and he'll be talking about law and the environment. That's June 19th. Here on Keeping the Faith, WILL AM 580, and heard also at 90.9 FM HD3 in Urbana, as well as online at will.illinois.edu. June 26, our guest will be Mark Johnson. He's the executive director for the Fellowship of Reconciliation in the United States. It's an international organization, and this is the oldest USA peace organization, interfaith peace organization, and he's going to be talking about whether or not there's a fear of peace that keeps that from happening in various places around the world. Those are some of the programs coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. I encourage you to listen as you can. If you can't hear them live, you can go to our archives that are very easily accessible via various devices. At will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. Well, we have another caller waiting, Joel. Let's go to a caller from Champaign, also on line one. You're on the air.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention when I was a younger person in fifth grade, my little public school had a special class for which they called it Education for the Advanced. And eight of us would gather. And one of the books that the teacher introduced us to was Madeleine L'Engle's
Time.
A Wrinkle in Time.
A Wrinkle in Time. Yeah. That is it, exactly.
Wonderful book.
So, wonderful book, and I don't know, it was an amazing thing, and still remember it to today.
Well, thank you.
One of the things that makes that so amazing, of course, is its integration of science with religion.
Yes.
And set a trend there that's continued by a British author today called Philip Pullman. You might have heard of his trilogy. Let's see, what did that start with?
Well, it was a great introduction to literature, and I appreciated so much that the public school system had that kind of thing for me.
Well, thank you for calling and sharing that with us.
Yeah, Philip Pullman, The Golden Compass, was the first book in that series, and The Subtle Knife was the second one, and Amber Spyglass being number three.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about books specifically that have religious themes or deal with spirituality, values, ethics, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
You commented to me as we were preparing the show that religion is often ignored in fiction, in books. But there are some wonderful exceptions, like the Madeleine L'Engle example.
Yeah, I was thinking that there's really kind of three different levels of the way this topic is approached in books. The first is benign neglect. You know, a lot of books are just written, and there's no mention of any religious activities, people going to church, teenagers attending youth groups, any of the things that we know lots of people still do in real life. And I was wondering to myself whether that was any different in the teen book world than it is in the adult book world. You know, if you took 100 books at random from the fiction shelves in the bookstore and you read through them to see, well, how many of them mention going to church or some other activity related to a religious belief? You know, I wonder what the percentage would be. I would guess that most books don't. You know, but there are books in those 100 which do. And there's usually two different levels. One is that the mention of religion or other kinds of religious or spiritual beliefs or activities is just integrated into the story, and it's fairly seamless, and you might hardly even notice it. It's just part of the character, part of the plot, part of the story, and it doesn't stand out in any particular way. And then, so an example of that, for example, I had a...
Was this where you mentioned Judy Blume?
Well, I was thinking of hers being a little more specific.
More central to the, okay.
Mid-80s book called Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. You know, it's where there's certainly the religious aspect is integrated into the plot, but it's not the primary thing. That might be a fairly good fit for that part of it. You know, each chapter in that book, if I recall correctly, ends with the character in the story, Judy Blume's character, Margaret, making a prayer, you know. But sometimes it was a very earthbound prayer, you know, make my breasts bigger or something, you know, let the right boy fall in love with me.
Sure.
And it was obviously meant to be humorous as well as instructive. And it makes, I think it's worth asking, you know, well, to what extent is this a subject teenagers want to know about? And I think it's fairly easy to say that we know teenagers are very idealistic in general, that they often want to know what they can do to help. They definitely have strong ideas about what's right and wrong, what's fair and not fair. They are strong advocates, you know, for social justice and other kinds of things that sometimes are problems we haven't solved as adults. And they, you know, what's the problem here? Why aren't we taking care of this? And so I think there is an audience, you know, in the teen world for books that deal with those kinds of questions, world issues. And certainly that's what much of realistic contemporary teen fiction is. You know, there's no, let's see, what was that Tolstoy quote? Remember in Anna Karenina, he said, all happy families are alike, but unhappy families are each unhappy in their own way. We'll just put teenagers in there. You know, any unhappy teenager is... All happy teenagers are alike, but an unhappy teenager is unhappy in his own way. When you read contemporary problem novels or most fiction, there's a conflict in there. There's a problem that has to be solved, and often multiple ones. Our teenagers' lives today are complicated, and there are huge problems that they have to deal with emotionally, psychologically, other kinds of important ways.
And it sounds like from what you were saying about the kind of books that get chosen by the best book committees and recommended to librarians and to readers are ones that, I mean, they are dealing with contemporary issues, and so they're almost all having to do with issues of values and ethics and how you make decisions and how do you solve problems and how do you survive these relationships that can be horrible.
What if we run through a few of those types?
Sure, give us...
A few sitting here in front of me. I actually went up to my shelves where I put books that I want to keep, you know, my own collection. I pulled a few that have some different angles on this. Let's start with, question of the afterlife. You know, certainly a central question to many religious beliefs is what happens when we die. There's a book by Gabriel Zevin, Z-E-V-I-N, called Elsewhere, that was very... popular with my students a few years ago when it came out. A girl, a 15-year-old named Liz, dies in a car accident, and she's really not willing to accept the fact that she's dead. She finds herself coming to consciousness on a cruise ship, and the story as it goes on explains that, yep, the cruise ship is taking her to some place where she's going to have her afterlife. When she gets there, it's a heaven-like place. She finds that there's a trick involved, that people age backwards. And so it becomes kind of a science fiction fantasy kind of thing, exploring the idea of what would happen if there was a place called Elsewhere where you got younger instead of older until you were reborn in a new body and a new soul, certainly incorporating some Eastern religious views there and themes in a very interesting way. Chris Crutcher is a very popular young adult author who's been writing now since the mid-80s and is often criticized for including too many problems in his book. You know, he has so many issues going on in one book that people say, teen's life, you know, this book has too much in it. And the rejoinder is always, teens' lives are complicated. There is a lot going on in their lives today. He wrote a book called The Sledding Hill about two boys who are best friends. One of them is over at the school gym one day in the summer, and a pile of plywood falls over and kills him. And it's the story of his continued efforts to have effects in the world, to affect the world from his position in the afterlife. We have a book called The Adoration of Jenna Fox by Mary Pearson that takes this idea in a different direction. It's kind of a spoiler alert here for you. If you don't want to know how this book ends, I might ruin it by saying the next word or two. When she wakes up, she finds out eventually that she's only about 10% human. You know, explores the idea of science fiction idea of cyborgs and asks the question, what makes us human? What part of us is essential to be human? Neil Schusterman wrote a book called Ever Lost, again, exploring the idea of life after death. And Mary Pearson's first book that I read, one of my favorites, this must have been 10 or 12 years ago, David V. God. In other words, David is a boy who is on a school field trip when his van crashes off the side of a mountain road down, and he's killed. I think maybe the rest of the people on the van were, too. He goes to heaven and ends up debating with God about why he should be allowed to return to Earth, not be dead yet. Very entertaining look, really, a funny approach to a very serious topic that I think teens could really relate to. So that's one little pile of books on one subtopic about life after death. There's another interesting subtopic having to do with saints that I've run across. Let me talk a little bit about some books that touch on especially Catholic saints. Han Nolan wrote a book called When We Were Saints, which asks the question, what is the line really between belief and madness? Two 14-year-old are best friends, a boy named Archie and a girl named Claire. And Claire, who's a very devout religious believer, talks Archie into stealing his grandfather's pickup truck so that he can drive her from where they live to New York City because she feels pulled to the cloisters that she visited once and believes that if she gets there, somehow she's, you know, going to accomplish sainthood or ultimate belief. And it's a very scary story as they go on this adventure together. An author named Kimberly Brubaker wrote a book called Leap of Faith about a girl named Abby who's forced by her parents to go to a Catholic middle school, and she's resistant. You know, she doesn't want to go there. She doesn't like the school uniform. She's making fun of it. But counter to my expectations as a reader, when as the book progresses, Abby finds true faith, truer than that of her parents. You know, a lot of the books that we read for young adults take the other approach and are negative toward certain religious practices and experiences. This one is one where her faith ends up being stronger at the end than it was at the beginning. And I've got to mention a woman named Freitas. Her last name is Freitas. Let's see, what was her first book? I must have lost my place here with her first one. Her first book was about a girl who wanted to be a saint. Where did that go? And she keeps writing to the Vatican proposing new saints that she could be And, you know, the funny one, of course, that comes up is related to the plug at the beginning of your show for This American Life about first kisses. She says, I could be the patron saint of kissing. That first boyfriend and that first kiss. Very humorous look, but very warm, again, about true, you know, devout Catholic belief. Her second book, Donna Friedis' second book, is called This Gorgeous Game, and integrates a subtext about Thomas Merton and his writings and his private life, about a 17-year-old girl named Olivia, who's a talented high school writer who wins a contest sponsored, is judged by a local famous Catholic theologian who's also a world-famous popular author. And she's thrilled to win the contest. She's going to get to attend his writing classes and learn from this fantastic mentor. But, of course, it turns scary when he essentially becomes a stalker and begins driving her crazy with constant contact, phone calls and emails and messages and constant demands on her time. Begins to be quite an impossible situation for her. So lots of books certainly can be found in the young adult collection that address not just issues in Catholic belief and Catholic Church, but many other kinds of particular religious views.
We're down to our last 5 or 6 minutes here on Keeping the Faith. We're talking with Joel Shoemaker by phone in Iowa City, a 25-year school librarian who has served on many committees looking at the best books for young adults, for teenagers, and has written a lot of recommending books through the School Library Journal and being an editor of a series for teens at the library. If you have a question or comment, we can still slip in a couple calls. The numbers again, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call.
Steve, could we talk about cults for a second?
Of course.
Well, you know, you're going to be familiar with some of these titles because sometimes when I review a book for School Library Journal or somebody else, I want to bounce my ideas off Steve as the expert in these matters. So I remember sending in this book called Leaving Fishers by Margaret Peterson Haddix. It came out quite a while ago now, 1995. It's about Dory, who's a new girl at school, and as she's sitting alone at the lunch table, somebody comes up and sits down next to her and befriends her and starts talking and says, hey, why don't you come over with our group Friday night? We always get together and have a lot of fun. And as Dory begins to become a part of this circle of friends, she finds out they're called the Fishers of Men and that they are, in fact, a religious group whose job is to go out and recruit new people to come in and become part of their church, their group. And in that particular case, Haddix's story, Leaving Fishers, is about the fact that she finds it hard to leave this. So I remember when I sent that book to Steve, you wrote back and said that it was a classic portrayal of the actual practices that are used by some groups on college campuses as well as high school story. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Well, I do remember that that book well, and it was very descriptive of techniques, of methods used to sort of lure young people into religious groups that really don't have their best interests at heart. We have another call waiting on line one from Champaign. You're on the air with Joel Shoemaker. Go ahead.
Hi. You started the show talking about kind of crossover books and trends that we're breaking, and I was going to kind of circle back to that with the theme you're talking about now with the values questions and also the speculative fiction that you were talking about earlier. The recent book, The Hunger Games, and that whole trilogy, I think it's going to turn into a movie and all that. I was wondering if you see a trend of this kind of post-apocalyptic theme in teen fiction and what you make of it. How seriously you think perhaps the issues are being taken compared to, say, grown-up, for lack of a better word, speculative fiction? Or is there a kind of a sense where the apocalypse or the powers that be or whatever can just be another frame off which to bounce some good old-fashioned teen angst. I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Thanks for the call.
Well, you know, apocalyptic is certainly a key word in both young adult fiction and in religious studies, isn't it?
Right.
Well, it wasn't too many days ago on the national news they were leading up to and then reporting on and then sort of joking about the people waiting for the apocalypse, waiting for the end of the world. A particular title I can mention that I have a note about here, Armageddon Summer by Jane Yolen, Yolen, and Bruce Coville, Coville. It was a 97 book about exactly that topic, a 14-year-old girl named Marina and a 16-year-old friend named Jen, whose parents are on a mountaintop with the believers awaiting the end of the world. So that's a literal apocalypse, and certainly we've got the science fiction-y kinds of apocalypses throughout children's and young adult literature over the last many, many years. They remain popular because I think it's a base part of who we are as people, you know, that things are one way now, but they won't necessarily always be that way. Will it get better or will it get worse? Well, the apocalypse is certainly one way of looking at what could happen if worse comes to worse.
Joel, we're down to our last 90 seconds, but let's slip in one more call, line two, real quick.
Yes, I've been interested in youth work and youth ministry all my career, and I'm delighted that the Shoemaker Brothers have introduced us to this wonderful spread of literature that's being published for youth. I didn't make it that way. I got to the cutoff, and the Fortress Press told me that they wouldn't take another of my writings because it just was... their market was mostly with adults, parents and teachers and so forth, and not with writers who were trying to help, as I was trying to contribute to that field. So thanks very much for this excellent program.
Appreciate the comment. Joel, any last book to recommend on historical fiction, like that last caller was writing?
Sure. Delia Ray is a local author that wrote Singing Hands about a fictionalized version of her mother's upbringing in 1948 in Birmingham. Her father is a Baptist minister to the deaf, and so this girl gets in trouble by humming along during the church service thinking nobody can hear her. It's a very interesting story about that leads also into some subtext about the racial situation in Birmingham at that time. Good historical fiction.
And we'll have to stop right there. We are out of time. I want to thank our guest, my brother, Joel Shoemaker from Iowa City, for being on Keeping the Faith this week. Next week, our guest will be Professor Eric Freifogel from this College of Law at the University, talking about law and the environment. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
It costs about $15 to broadcast a minute of programming on WILL. Programs like Morning Edition, Focus, and Classic Mornings are made possible by listeners who give a few minutes of financial support for their favorite program. You can help WILL reach its membership goal of $2.1 million by June 30th when you contribute a few of your minutes of financial support at willpledge.org.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 5.